what is endurance other than the prolonged process of suppressing your very natural and logical desire to slow down? You have to keep resisting your natural urge, and that's a fatigable task.
This is Running for Real, the podcast for runners who know that for every runner's high, there are just as many lows. All those just missed PRs, easy runs that feel hard, injury blues, and more. Each week, we'll talk to running, health, and wellness experts about their highs, lows, and best advice to build our confidence. Running for Real is about being honest, being brave, and most of all, not feeling alone. And now here's our host, whose bucket list included visiting Carlos Bakery, Tina Muir.
Hello, my friends. Welcome to episode 98 of the Running for Real podcast. So close to 100 now, getting really excited for this. I'm trying to come up with something that is big enough to celebrate this, as it is a huge occasion, and I'm looking forward to kind of celebrating it with you. If you are a new listener, welcome to the show. I hope you enjoyed this episode. And if you do, I would love if you would subscribe to the Running for Real podcast through your favorite podcast player. And then you can get all the future episodes come straight to your phone or your, well, however you listen, whatever podcast player you listen, straight to you every Friday. And actually on Mondays too with the bonus episodes. If you are a regular listener, welcome back. Thanks so much for tuning in. Now, last week we had Dr. Tom Michaud on the show, and we talked all about lower body injuries, kind of our feet, how to strengthen them, how we can kind of look forward to the future and make sure that we are avoiding things. Now, as you probably heard, Tom is the king of research. He just knows so much stuff off the top of his head. He's really into the research, and it was just a great episode. He's just the nicest guy, and I hope you really enjoyed that one. Now, today I have another person who's really interested in research, but kind of more of a different area. Tom was more kind of on the physical, the injuries side of thing. And today, this is someone I know you love to hear from. He's one of the best writers in our industry. He does the research and then shares his findings with us in a way we can all understand. Alex Hutchinson is back on the show, and I'd love to make Alex a regular guest, as I think he has so much to share. And maybe if you enjoy this one, share a screenshot of the podcast and tag him in it on your social media. We can get enough of them to convince him to kind of join me as essentially a co-host from time to time. So help me get him there in the future. Now, before we get on with this episode, I just want to remind you that my book on overcoming amenorrhea is coming out in just under a week. And this is the time when you can pre-order it. If you pre-order it, that gives me a massive heads up to Amazon to say, hey, this is something good, and they will hopefully pay attention. I'm really proud of this book. It contains my full story and what I recommend to do to get your period back, as well as what I think you can do to feel more confident in who you are. Sally, who is one of our superstars communities, told me she thinks everyone who struggles with body image or confidence should read this, which was a really nice compliment for me. And I really tried to make it speak to all of us to believe in ourselves and see the good we should be offering the world, because we do have good to offer the world. If you want to pre-order the book, you can find a link in the show notes or by visiting tinamuir.com/pre-order. That's one word, pre-order. And that will direct you to the right page. Thank you so much in advance. Let's go chat to Alex. You're committed to being your best. You want more energy, better performance, and improved overall health. Maybe you've tried a diet that you read about online and taken a few supplements you heard are important. It's time to stop guessing and start improving. Inside Tracker is committed to help you get there using science and technology. Their cutting-edge algorithm engine will analyze your blood and your lifestyle to guide you to goals with actionable, personalized recommendations. Take advantage of a special opportunity for my listeners. Use code TINA for 20% off their plans at insidetracker.com. If you're planning to test a couple of times throughout the year, that will help you measure progress, and you'll see an extra discount added automatically when you check out. Alex, I am so excited to have you back once again on the Running for Real podcast. Always love our conversations, and I know my listeners do too. So thank you so much for being here today.
Well, thank you so much, Tina. It is fun, and we'll hope that both of our respective children stay asleep in the adjoining rooms so that it stays like a nice, quiet conversation.
And hope they don't kind of work together to talk to each other and say, let's make some noise together and see just how much disruption we can make. Let's hope that's exactly not the case. All right. So we last talked in March. When that was the case, Endure had been out, I think, a few months. It was recent either way. And just to kind of begin, how's the reception been of the book? Has it done well? Have you been excited to see the conversations that have been coming from it? Like, tell us a bit about that.
Yeah, definitely. It's been much more exciting and enthusiastic than I could have hoped for. I've heard feedback from a lot of people, ranging from, you know, people I don't know to really top runners. I mean, it was exciting to see stuff. People from like Evan Jagger saying how much he enjoyed the book. So we're talking like Olympic medalists here. It's exciting to hear it in their conversations, and it's just exciting to see that it's reached a lot of people. So, it's better than I could have hoped, because I spent a long time working on this, and my standard approach to life is to assume that things aren't going to go very well, and then be pleasantly surprised if they go better than the worst possible scenario. And so I've been very, very pleasantly surprised all year.
So would you say you're a pessimist then?
Yeah,
you're a realist. You're probably going to say, aren't you?
No, what I would say is that I have a big layer of pessimism, which is maybe a bit ironic, or given that what I talk about in the book about the role of positive self-talk. But I think that role of that exterior pessimism is because internally, deep down, I'm actually a super optimist. I have, like, on the rare occasions when I've bought lottery tickets, I'm always totally surprised when I don't win. Like, I expect the world to go well. And so as a result, I have to fight against that urge by talking down my expectations, because actually deep down, I really am pretty optimistic and so I think it's a superficial pessimism to counteract my optimism.
Okay, fair enough. I was going to say, I was like, if you were a pessimist, like, that would be really surprising, but good to know. Now, when you mentioned about, not expecting it to, you know, not having high expectations of it, or not really knowing where it's going to go, as this year has unfolded, you know, I have written a book on overcoming amenorrhea myself, which actually comes out in about a week as this is going to go live. But I've kind of struggled with, you always want to add more. As soon as you submit it, I should have added this, or I wanted to add this. Have you, now that you've had this year to kind of reflect on it, what are some things that you've maybe learned about that you've thought, oh, I would have loved to add that in there? Or what are some things that kind of may have niggled at you thinking that would have been great to include?
Yeah, I mean, that's definitely an issue. And it's, you know, it's one of the main reasons the book didn't come out in like 2013 instead of 2018, is that, especially because I'm writing about an area that is a subject of active research, it's like every week I find new studies that are relevant to what I was writing about, and that maybe change the nuance about something that I discussed in the book. To be totally honest, because it's so fluid at the moment, that makes it actually easier for me to be at peace with what's in the book, because there is no, it's not like, oh, if there was one more thing, then it would be complete. It's like, there's always one more thing.
Yeah, that makes sense.
Probably one area that I wrote about quite a bit in the book was the 2-hour marathon. And things have changed. So I wrote that. Basically, I'd finished the book by the time the Breaking 2 marathon took place. And I went back and added some sections that discussed the idea of Breaking 2, just because it was so topical and I'd had some good reporting material on it. But it was still sort of fresh, this idea of trying to break 2. It seemed sort of crazy. And since then, a lot has happened, including, you know, Eliud Kipchoge ran 2:01:39 in September, and it changes our perspective on how close that is, and changes our perspective on the things that go into making a 2-hour marathon. So I've thought a lot more since the book came out about Eliud Kipchoge's mindset, rather than just about the shoes he was wearing and the drafting and things like that. And so obviously in the book, I do talk, you know, my last chapter is a lot about mindset, and I sort of give a few sentences nod to saying Eliud Kipchoge has a, you know, remarkable self-belief, but I would have liked to explore that in more detail. I think that's, you know, almost worth a chapter of its own, looking more closely at what exceptional athletes like Eliud Kipchoge bring to the table and how their personal experiences relate to some of the research that I was discussing in the book about things like motivational self-talk.
Mm-hmm. Which I would love to kind of go on and talk about this right now with, you know, what he has done, what you have learned. So tell us a bit about that. As you know, Eliud Kipchoge running 201.39 had quite an impact on you. I loved reading your Outside Online article the day, or maybe a few days after that came out. I'll put that in the show notes. But for those who haven't read it, kind of tell us about what was going through your mind when this happened.
Yeah. So, I mean, what I'd like to sort of pat myself on the back for is that I wrote an op-ed in the New York Times predicting that after Kipchoge's experience in the Breaking 2 project, where he ran sort of 2 hours, 0 minutes, 25 seconds under very artificial conditions, I said, okay, that's not a real marathon, but it's going to change his mental approach to the marathon. And I think that's going to allow him to not just sort of nibble away at the world record, but to demolish it. And so I predicted in this Times piece that he would run 201 something in Berlin. Now, the problem is that I predicted that in 2017 when he ran his first race after Breaking 2, and that didn't happen. And it didn't happen in London in 2018. And it finally happened a year after I predicted it in Berlin 2018. So in a sense, by the time this fall rolled around, the bloom had come off the rose in terms of my optimism. And I thought, well, maybe the window's passed. Maybe we're not entering the era of the 201 marathon. And then he did it. And so I sort of say, oh, wait, I did predict this last year. So to me, it was kind of a delayed reaction to the Breaking 2 thing. I really think that without that experience of having seen his legs cover, you know, 26.2 miles in just over 2 hours, he wouldn't have set out to run the first half in Berlin in 61 minutes. And then having done that, he wouldn't have had the chutzpah to accelerate at that mm-hmm. point and to get faster. So, you know, it's easy to sort of drift into very facile explanations about how it was all in his head. He broke down the mental barriers and it became easier. I don't want to sort of make it sound like that's all it was. Like, obviously he's in monster shape and a lot of things had to come together for him to run that, the race that he did. But I think there is some contribution from this idea that he gained the confidence or the belief that he could do it from that admittedly artificial experience in the Breaking 2 race.
Mm-hmm. And I want to talk about his mindset in a minute. As you mentioned, that is an important piece of this. But before we go on, as you just mentioned, you did predict when you thought that 201 was going to happen. Now, I would love for you to give us a prediction, and I'm sure you're going to hate this, of when you think the sub 2 will happen.
Yeah, so I should start with a little background on my own history of predictions, that in 2014 in Runner's World, I predicted it would be 2075. So I was very pessimistic at that point. Going back to my to our discussion of am I a pessimist or an optimist, I said 2075, maybe not because I really believed that would be it, but because I would rather be seen to be too you know, not optimistic enough than to be seen as a sort of wild fool who thinks it's going to happen tomorrow.
Do you remember what the time your optimist did think at that moment?
At that point, you know, it's very vague, but it wouldn't have shocked me at that point if it had happened in 2030 or something like that. That's the sort of range I would have thought. If you were to plot it out, if in 2014 you just took the graph of world marathon records and took the most recent sequence of rapid progress that's been since about 1998, you could say, oh, it's going to happen by 2025 or 2030. And so there was a not crazy rationale to say, well, if things keep going like they have been for the last 15 years or 20 years, we'll see one in the 2020s or in 2030. But my caution, or maybe my fear, and I'm not saying this is a good thing, but that sort of mental approach made me say 2075. So I don't think it's going to be 2075 anymore. I think it'll be sooner than that. And I think now that we're in the 201s, I think most of the people, and there were a lot of them, who said 2 hours is simply not possible for humans. That's crazy. You're all, you know, stupid for even discussing it. I think those people have kind of faded away into the woodwork. Mm. And I think most people think it can be done. Although there's another caveat that I don't mean to ramble on about this, but another caveat that we should mention here is, look, he's wearing these 4% shoes, the Nike Vaporfly, and it's still unclear exactly the extent to which it changes the game for marathoners. So maybe he's no faster than Dennis Kometo was 4 years ago. And so the illusion of progress is just that now he's got the shoes, and unless someone invents even better shoes, no one's going to run faster than 201. So in predicting things, we have to say, like, okay, well, what's going to happen with shoe technology? What's going to happen with the rules? Is the IAAF going to say, oh man, if people are breaking the world record by over a minute, this suggests that these shoes are crazy and we need to step in and put some sort of limits on midsole thickness or something like that. So that could push things farther back again. Having said all that, I would say if things continue as they are and nothing crazy changes, I would imagine that now that we're getting so close, there's going to be money that becomes available to stage races, sort of like Nike's Breaking 2 race, but within the rules. Mm. So let's say a race on a Formula One racetrack under perfect conditions, but not with six pacemakers, swapping in and out illegally throughout the race. And if we do that, then I could, and if there's huge prize pots put up, then I could see it in the next, let's say, 10 to 15 years getting down below.
So you would say it's going to be in a situation like that rather than, on a course like Berlin where the crowds are lining the streets, you think it is more going to be a time trial essentially situation?
Eliud Kipchoge's marathon history gives us a window on why I would say that, which is that you could argue that he's been in world marathon record shape for 2 or 3 years. But, Berlin last year, it rained. London, it was the hottest London marathon earlier this year, the hottest London marathon in history. Finally, Berlin this year, he got good conditions, not the greatest. The pacemakers didn't pan out. Two of them dropped out after about 15K, and the weather was maybe a little warmer than optimal. But so in a sort of marathon in the wild, there's all sorts of things that aren't quite optimal. So could it happen under those conditions? Sure. But I think then you're saying we have to wait till we have a person who's capable of it, who has a good day on the right day, and also all the environmental conditions line up perfectly. Whereas you can remove, and so it could still happen. It's just going to take longer before all those balls line up in a row. Whereas you can get to that point a little more quickly if you control some of those options.
Okay.
Now you mentioned the crowds cheering. Maybe there's something about Berlin that's better than an artificial time trial or Berlin or some other big city marathon. Maybe you lose something by going to a Formula One racetrack and not having it as a sort of real race where it's more of a time trial. And so these are legitimate questions, and it may turn out to be the other way around. It may turn out that ultimately you're going to be better off as part of a real race where there's real meaning and it doesn't feel like a sort of setup. But I think my feeling is that it'll probably happen in a specially set up exhibition event.
Okay. Because you must have experienced that yourself, with as fast as you have run, the extra kind of taking in that energy of kind of, be it a physical level of just hearing people cheer or just it feels like it's kind of going into your soul, essentially, where people are cheering and it's just kind of bringing that buzz. Like I have to think that has some kind of impact on, just being able to help you dig down. I mean, Paula Radcliffe has talked a lot about being at London and kind of taking in the crowd's energy. So,
I definitely agree with that. And I can say personally, I'm someone who has, among the biggest differentials that I know of between what I can do in practice and what I can do in a race. For me, there's I can't just go out to the track and run anywhere near what I'm capable of running in a race. There's just no comparison. Of course, I've never run a time trial where the prize was $1 million. So, there may be ways of compensating for the crowd support. And also the marathon is interesting. I've thought about this question before and my sort of back of the envelope plan for what would be optimal is you run the first, let's say 20 to 30K on a nice quiet Formula One track that runs through a park like Monza was where the Breaking 2 race was. There's birds chirping and there's not a lot of people there. You just have someone keeping track. because the marathon's a long way. You don't want to get super
calm.
Excited.
Yeah.
You just want to get out there because the first half of the marathon should feel totally under control. So you run that totally under control. And then whether it's at, 21K or 25K or 30K, you exit the stadium and you start running this gradually downhill road loop that's just within the legal limit of how far you're allowed to go downhill in a total race, surrounded by, thousands of spectators lining the route, screaming their heads off, because that's when you need the surge. So you don't necessarily want to be amped up to 11 out of 10 the whole race. But I do think that last 10K, 10 to 15K of the marathon, 10 to 12K, let's say, it could really help to have to feel like the eyes of the world, not just to sort of know intellectually that people are watching, but to feel the energy of the crowd alongside.
Well, I'm sure someone is working on that as we speak, figuring out a way of doing it. So chop, chop, get on with it if that is you and you're the race director. Okay, so once it does happen, do you think it will be kind of like the 4-minute mile where lots more people will do it? Or is this truly something that few people can accomplish?
I think once one person does it, somebody else will do it. Mm-hmm. And it will continue, every 5 years or so, there's a scientific paper that argues that we've reached the sort of ultimate limits of human performance and that we're not going to see any more world records. And, this has been happening since the 1920s. It's basically, you get these sorts of papers saying, well, we've kind of, this is about as much as we can do. And there was one right around, the New York Times published a big article on one of the scientific papers earlier this year around the 2018 Olympics saying, we've kind of reached the end of world records. And it's like, yeah, except that you get someone like Usain Bolt and he improves by like, In the most mature event there is no event that is more like mature and also less susceptible to technological change than like the 100-meter dash. And yet he came along and ran 1.5 seconds or 1.5% rather faster than, or something like that, a significant gap faster than anyone had gone before. So yeah, I think once one person does it, more people will do it. I think it'll be like the 4-minute mile in that, in hindsight, people will talk about how it was just a mental barrier. And once people knocked it down, it became easy. And in reality, when you look at the numbers, you'll find that it remained really hard.
Yeah.
And that it didn't become easy for the 4-minute mile. And the 2-hour marathon will certainly never be easy. And is likely to be something that will always be a huge challenge. But yeah. I don't think there'll be like one guy does it and then it's like, well, that's it for humanity. No one else is going to get there.
Okay, cool. And then finally on this topic, the Vaporfly, the Nike Vaporfly you've mentioned, my question was going to be kind of, are they really all they've been built up to be? But it kind of sounds like that is the case. So for the average listener, if they bought themselves a pair, can they expect huge improvements? Or is this something that is kind of designed to work with very efficient running strides and the perfect kind of runner?
So I think the evidence suggests that it works for a wide variety of runners. And there was a big New York Times analysis of Strava data, which was very much not focused on elite runners, but just on everybody who had entered in, the pairs of shoes they ran marathons in. And so based on a lot of examples, they found that the Vaporfly seemed to be a couple percent faster. Now it's hard to separate out different effects. Maybe once you've spent whatever, $250 on a pair of shoes, you're really motivated not to slow down at the end of the marathon. So there's a lot going on there. I would say, the shoe is called the Vaporfly 4%. That refers to your efficiency, not your speed. You're not going to get 4% faster necessarily, but are you going to get 1% faster maybe, or 1.5 or 2? It's hard to know. I think the evidence suggests that yes, on average, you probably will. Not everyone will. Some people will get more, some people will get less. And once you put them on your feet, you will never know how much of what you're getting out of yourself was the shoe and how much was, other things that your training, your execution, your mental approach. And so I have to admit, I'm pretty torn about these shoes. I think there's actually a pretty good rationale for that we should change rules and ban these sorts of shoes, just because running is such a simple sport.
Mm-hmm. Have you run in them yourself?
So I got a review pair from Runner's World just before I left Runner's World. The timing worked out that they arrived. They took so long to send them to me that they arrived after I'd stopped working for Runner's World. So then I had nothing to review them for, and so I had this pair of very expensive shoes, which at the time were extremely hard to get hold of. Like there was these supply shortages. So I felt like I had this extremely valuable thing. And I looked at them and I thought, I can't run in these. So they sat on my shelf for 6 months. And then finally, I was running a 5K earlier this year. And I guess it was April, May or something like that. And I thought, well, I've got these shoes. I'll give them a shot. So I ran one tempo run in them, and then I ran this 5K, and that's all I've run in them. And to answer the obvious question, I have no idea if they made me faster, but the scientific evidence suggests that they probably did. They probably gave me a percent or something in that 5K. But I just it's I don't know, and that's kind of one of the reasons that I'm sort of not super comfortable with them, especially because it's not like. Beet juice is a great example of something that you might say is similar, which is another thing that I've written a lot about, but never or almost never tried. And beet juice, it's whatever, it's $5 or something like that. But when a pair of shoes is $250, it's tricky. It's tricky. Like I the last thing I would want is to like imagine a ruling that says, okay, Eliud Kipchoge's 201 is no longer world marathon record is now disallowed. Like wow, that would be. Really, really challenging for the sport.
Which they could well do, right? Because of, I think back to like Paula Radcliffe, her 215 is no longer counted. So surely in the future, they could go back on their decision with that.
Yeah, absolutely. They could. Would it be the right decision is a tougher question. And I think you can say with some justification that, well, they should have regulated the shoes in 2017 when they came out, and then we wouldn't have this problem. Of course, by then it was already too late in the sense that Kipchoge had won the Olympics in those shoes, and both the men's and women's gold medals were won in those shoes before they were even revealed to the public. So it was kind of it made it difficult right from the start to think about regulating them. But in terms of whether the average runner should go out and buy a pair of shoes to get faster, I guess I would say right now it's within the rules, and if you do it, there's a good chance you'll gain, a minute or two over a marathon. And if that, like, look, if you're if you're trying to qualify for Boston and you're right on the bubble,
could make the difference. Yeah.
It could make the difference. And if I was in that boat where you're competing against an external benchmark, something like the Boston qualifier, which is, it's not how fast can I go, it's can I go faster than this particular external benchmark. And it's within the rules, then I'd say, hey, that's maybe something worth considering. For me, I'm these days, I'm mostly competing against myself. I'm wondering how fast I can run relative to what I ran last week or last year. And so it makes no sense to me to sort of tip the scales and then I don't know if I'm faster than I was last year. I don't know anything. So it's a tricky question, and I it's something I've been wrestling with a lot lately.
Yeah. And when you did try them on that one time, did you feel any mental or kind of emotional, like, oh, this is making me faster? Did that affect you in any way? Or did you try and consciously ignore it as much as you could?
No, I tried to nurture that. I tried to, what I wanted was to say, I don't know whether these shoes are going to work, but I want to feel like I am the basically it's a 5K that I've run every year for the last 5 years. And a bunch of my friends run it. And I didn't have a good, because of the book coming out, I was super busy and didn't have good training leading into this race. And I thought, all right, now's the time to pull out all the stops. And so I want to harness this belief that I'm going to be faster. So I was deliberately trying to take advantage of all the sort of mental stuff that swirls around this idea that shoes can make you faster. And, but at the same time, I one of my sort of mantras of understanding performance is that you can always fool yourself. You have no idea. Like so my sense at the end of the race of like, did I go faster in those shoes? I don't even know what my sense was, 'cause I don't pay attention to it, 'cause I have zero faith in my ability to subjectively tell whether I went faster in those. That's why I'm interested in looking at the data rather than in my, 'cause I know I'm capable of tricking myself. So, who knows what they did, but I did try and harness that belief to make me believe that yes, even though I'm not as fit as I usually am, I can still go out at my usual pace.
Well, and I guess you kind of have to do that. If you're going to put these shoes on, you might as well make the most of, most of that kind of belief that it allows you to have. And that kind of segues quite nicely into, you mentioned at the beginning about, after you'd finished in writing Endure, that you've since learned a lot more about, Eliud Kipchoge's, mindset and kind of belief. And I would love for you to kind of share some of the things you've learned, and then we'll maybe talk about how other people listening can maybe bring some of that on within their own running.
Yeah. I mean, in a sense, it's actually not even so much that I learned more about Kipchoge as that I thought more carefully about what he had been saying when I talked to him. So for example, when I first interviewed him, I asked, he had just run a half marathon in about 1 hour, just under 1 hour. And he was planning to run a full marathon, hopefully in 2 hours. And so I asked him, like, how are you going to change your training to be able to go twice as far at roughly the same pace? And his answer was, I'm not going to change my training. I'm just going to change my, you know, the training will be the same, but my mind will be different. And to me at the time, that was sort of amusing, right? Like, it was like, well, you know, what a quirky guy. But as I thought back on this, it turned out that he was much more sincere about this than I realized, that he was in all the interviews he gave, he was saying things like, you know, you think it's impossible and I think it's possible. And so once I started to think more carefully about the research into things like motivational self-talk, I realized, you know, what he's doing is textbook examples of making sure that he has positive self-talk during the race. And we can get more into that. But, the other example that came out after the book, and I mentioned a little bit in the book, is the idea of smiling and facial expressions being linked to emotions. But instead, what happened during breaking two is that Kipchoge was smiling during the race. People noticed that he was giving these deliberate smiles. And the same thing during the world marathon record. He was smiling deliberately. And so after breaking two came out, some research came out of Northern Ireland where they asked people to smile on a treadmill or to frown or whatever the case may be. And they found that when people were smiling, their running economy was 2% better, which meant that they could run roughly the same at the same pace while burning 2% less energy.
Wow. That's really interesting. And was he aware of stuff like this, like research like this coming out, or is this just something he kind of innately had within him to know that he needs to, I don't know, has he worked with sports psychologists and kind of learned these skills, or is this something he just does?
I can't fully answer for him, but my impression is that this is stuff that he has intuited, and that it's not coming from a sports psychologist, and it's deliberate. It's not just that happening randomly, he's thinking carefully about it, and he's doing it because he believes it will help him run. And his explanation is, look, when I run, I don't run with my just with my legs, I run with my heart and my mind. And the smile helps me connect my legs to my heart and my mind. So it turns out that what he's doing is exactly what a sports psychologist would recommend. But I don't think he's being told that by sports psychologists.
Interesting. And on that note, okay, so in the past, people maybe at the top level, or just to be a good athlete, to reach your potential, you kind of almost had to have this like fighting approach. Like, I'm going to dig down, I'm going to be gritty, I'm going to be tough, and I'm going to, you know, muscle my way through this. But it seems like what you just said right there, and just kind of what the research is coming out with, that this kind of fighting approach is not always the best way to go. And actually, it's more about kind of being positive and like you said, smiling, seeing the good in the situation. Tell us about what you have found with regards to that, with, you know, taking time to smile. You know, I can't imagine in the past, I definitely think growing up, I would never have smiled, because I remember, you know, anytime you'd go past a photographer, you had to look ahead and narrow your eyes. I'm so determined, look at me. Whereas now it's, you know, you may be smiling because you're kind of trying to enjoy the moment and it helps you run faster. So what are your thoughts on that? And has there been a shift there?
Yeah, that's a great point. And I think one of the things that really highlights is the sort of danger of trying to formulate general rules like when you run, you should smile. It's like, well, what we found is that smiling can have a positive effect. Is it the right thing to do at all points during a race? Well, there are lots of people who would tell you they need to get into the sort of fight zone for running. They need to be angry. They need to be visualizing themselves stomping all over their competitors or whatever. There may be different things in different contexts. So what I can tell you from my personal experience of sort of playing around with my facial expression or even my thoughts. When I'm, let's say I'm doing a tempo run by myself, I will often notice that my face is sort of contorted into a grimace of effort. Mm-hmm. And I'll think to myself, hey, I've just read all this fascinating research. I should try and, if not smile, then at least relax my face, you know, not have this face of effort that will probably be increasing my sense of effort. And when I do that, it's amazing how quickly, you know, I relax my face. And it's amazing how quickly I feel, oh, that feels much easier. That does feel more relaxed. And then I'll check my next split and I'll be like, oh, that's because I slowed down. Like, but relaxing, I kind of took some of my edge off. Mm. And so that wasn't helpful. And so my sort of heuristic for myself is, if I'm trying to keep up with someone, let's say in a race or in a workout with a training partner, I'm desperately trying to keep up with someone. So my pace is being dictated by the person I'm trying to keep up with. And what I want to do is make it feel as easy as possible. Then I will focus on relaxing my face. And, you know, I'm not a big smiler myself, but, you know, to me, it's at least not frowning is a good step. Mm-hmm. But if I'm out there trying to push my pace myself, let's say on a tempo run, or let's say I'm leading a race or a workout or something, or trying to pull away from someone, then I actually almost like to feel the snarl of effort on my face and to remind myself, this is hard and it's supposed to be hard. And this mm-hmm. is where I'm going to make the other person suffer. And so for me, there's a contextual thing that one approach works best when I'm trying to feel easy while maintaining my pace. And another approach works best when I'm trying to make it hard and remind myself and not let myself forget that every step is supposed to be hard. And I don't think that will be true for everybody, but I think everybody needs to figure out an experiment and figure out what makes them feel fast or slow or easy or hard or motivated or unmotivated. And it's different if you're racing against a person versus against the clock. Mm. Like it's hard to feel sort of aggressive against the clock. But when you're racing against a person, maybe you can harness some of that competitive fire that's different from trying to push yourself against an abstract like the clock. So that's a whole mishmash of thoughts. But I guess to get back to your question of, you know, is there a shift from being sort of aggressively competitive to being happy out there? I think there's more of a recognition now mm. that there can be a role for being relaxed and sensing enjoyment. But I don't think that's the only approach. And I also think the other important thing to make is that, let's say running a marathon, it's not about having one thought sustain for those 3+ hours. You're going to go through a lot of thoughts and you're going to want to have a lot of mental tactics to pull out of your deck to address at different points in the race. And so there's a guy named Noel Brick, who's a Northern Irish researcher who's doing some amazing work on what runners think about or what endurance athletes think about during races. And one of his big themes is you should have this array of mental strategies, not think about having one mental strategy, but you should, you know, at one point in the race, you should be doing a check on your body, maybe, mm. but you're not spending the whole race checking your form. And then maybe you're going to be thinking about your pace. Maybe you're going to be thinking about your competitors. Maybe you're going to be distracting yourself at some point. Maybe between miles 5 and 10 of a marathon, the best thing to think about is, you know, that great camping trip you went on last summer or whatever, not for the whole race. So it's never a question of like, pick the best strategy and stick to it for the whole race. It's be aware of the strategy that it might help you during a tough patch during a race, but maybe it's not what you need at the beginning or the end or some other point in the race.
I think that's really good. And actually the last marathon I did, every time I picked up one of my water bottles, being in Italy, I did have the luxury of having the bottles on the course, but every time I picked it up, I had a new mantra, and the early ones were kind of making me feel good about myself and kind of being about in the moment. I said, you know, do it for the fans, the people watching. And then towards the end, it was getting more and more serious. Like it became my my sports psychologist around mile 15. I wanted to think of words she had said to me, because that's the part where you're like, oh, I've still got a really long way. And then it became about my strength coach at mile 18, because that's when your form starts to break down. And then the last two were really about like kind of gritty, like you're doing this for you. And I think that kind of, that really helped me having that transition of more relaxed topics early on, and then getting to the later part of the race. And then it kind of becomes more serious and more kind of about fighting and digging down deep. So I think I just wanted to mention that because I know a lot of people go into races, even standing on the start line of a marathon, thinking like, this is it. I've got to, you know, got to go for it. And I've worked so hard for this and I've got to push myself. But as you mentioned, do that too early and you'll mentally burn yourself out before you even, you know, get to the part that matters. So
yeah, your approach of having this sort of gradually shifting series of mantras is like exact. I mean, obviously you're well aware of this. This is exactly what sports psychologists mm-hmm. would recommend. You know, there are different thoughts that are going to be optimal for you at different stages in the race. And if you've planned them out in advance, it's very hard to make up a plan as you go along. So if you've carefully plotted out what you want to think at different points, that's really helpful. And even if you know the course, like, whether it's at specific water bottles or specific aid stations or a specific landmark, whether it's Heartbreak Hill or whatever the case may be, mm-hmm. it can be a cue. And so, yeah, maybe you're relaxed and happy and feeling good about yourself for the first part of the race, but maybe towards the end of the race, there's a cue that you're going to, as soon as you see that, you know, that turn in the course, you're going to get fired up and remember how hard you've worked and all the sort of cliched, hyper-motivational mm-hmm. stuff. Maybe that's the time for that. So, yeah, it takes some planning in advance, though. And it's not just something you can sort of roll with once the race starts.
And that is a great thing. Actually, on that note, this leads in perfectly. You know, I know a lot of my listeners are worried about, you know, they'll say being tougher. You've kind of explained in your book Endure that it's not quite as simple as you learn to be tougher. But for some people who think that, you know, they hear that they've got to work on these mental strategies, they've got to work on their ability to endure in training, but they feel like they're constantly failing in training. Like, I can't do this. I mentally give up. I'm not strong enough. I just get the sense that people often feel like they are the only ones who are kind of struggling mentally and the only ones who are kind of allowing those negative thoughts to come through. So what would be your advice for someone who feels like they are giving up in training and they're thinking, how am I going to do this in a race if I can't even do it in my training?
Yeah, I mean, the first thing I think, like you said, is to make clear that this is the universal human experience. Mm. I mean, I know, you know, whenever I talk about motivational self-talk, one of the things I say is like, we all have these monologues. And if your monologue is like mine during a race, you know, for me, the thoughts that go through my head during a race, early in the race, are along the lines of like, why am I doing this? This is so stupid. I'm going to fail again. Like, it's just, your brain has all sorts of very clever and hardwired ways of trying to convince you to stop things that are hard. And it really tries to undermine you. And the goal is not necessarily to get rid of those thoughts, because you're not necessarily, you can't just sort of turn them off completely, mm-hmm. but you can contextualize them so that you can understand where they're coming from and you can acknowledge them and just say, okay, I hear that, but I'm going to, you know, I've trained for this and I'm going to keep going. So I think it can maybe be a little counterproductive to imagine that you're going to get rid of all those negative thoughts or that you're never going to feel like you've given in too early. And I think what's important to understand also is that we talk about working on these mental approaches, there's a lot you can do to work on your mental approaches. But to me, the number one thing, the best thing you can do is just to get out there and do your training each day and each week and put yourself in that discomfort, you know, week after week, not day after day. You know, not every day should be, you know, practicing suffering. But if you're consistently doing some hard workouts, you're going to be building up a series of strategies, mental strategies that you can use to handle discomfort. And you know, I really think that just going through it and doing it is the best way to start. Of course, some people are better than others, and some people get the impression they're bad because their goal setting during training is maybe a little too ambitious. And mm-hmm. so they're setting themselves up for failure on a consistent basis. And it takes some subtlety to sort of set goals appropriately. You don't want to just set yourself the goals that are easy to achieve every time. And so you're never pushing yourself. But at the same time, if you're always, and I've certainly trained with people who essentially dropped out of every hard workout before the plan finished because they were always expecting to be able to do more than they were capable of. And, you know, week after week, year after year. And it's like, you've dropped out of like 117 consecutive workouts. Isn't it time to reevaluate what you're capable of? And so you have to be able to be responsive to what's working and what's not working for you.
So on that note, for someone who has got themselves in a bad pattern of giving up or maybe cutting things short, do you have any advice for how to get yourself back to doing that? Because it is a very much a situation where once you start doing it, it's very difficult to stop, especially if, as you mentioned, it's happened often.
Yeah. I mean, obviously there are lots of different ways this can happen, lots of reasons it can happen. And so the solution for everyone isn't the same. I guess the advice that I give when I, you know, I've certainly trained with a lot of people who would terminate workouts prematurely when mm-hmm. they weren't going well. And with that, a sense of failure and something that maybe translates into races where you feel like if it's not going well, it's time to just pull the plug. And my advice there in that sort of situation is, and this is maybe a little controversial, but my advice is, okay, if you're in that situation, you need to commit to what workout you're going to do and finish the workout regardless of the pace. Mm-hmm. So, I mean, step one is obsess less about pace. You could also say, like, obviously don't start as fast, start easier so that you'll finish the workout. But independent of that, let's say you do start too fast, you're still going to finish the workout. Even if you have to slow down dramatically, let's say you're doing, you know, six times a mile or something like that, and you do the first two really well, and then you start getting fast, slower and slower. And by the fourth one, you're slower than you intended. Instead of dropping out, you do the fifth one, the sixth one, and they're just going to be slower. Now, that advice has some risks. If you're like getting hurt or if you're overtrained or something, I'm not saying that you should be like dragging your carcass around the track to finish the workout no matter what. But I think especially if you've gotten into that habit of like, you're really trying to do your best and sometimes you just cook it too hard and feel you need to drop out. It's like, no, you don't need to drop out. You're going to finish it. And that's going to teach you, in my view, to pace yourself better mm-hmm. because it's not fun to finish a workout when you've gone out too hard. And so if you don't give yourself a get out of jail free card, if you know that you're going to have to finish the workout no matter what, you're going to start to be a little bit more careful about paying attention. But also just more generally, I think if you're in that habit of workouts going wrong and having and you know feeling like you failed, I think you need to de-emphasize the importance of the workouts and the pace in the workouts and understand that if someone tells you to do 5 by a mile in such and such a pace, that's not like a sort of holy commandment handed down from mm-hmm. on high. The work, what that really translates into is I want you to work hard for let's say 6 minutes and then take 2 minutes break and then work hard for 6 minutes, and then take 2 minutes break, at whatever pace that turns out to be. And if you can't do the pace that someone else thinks you should do, that is what it is. Mm-hmm. you do the pace you can do. One thing I would say, just from my own experience, I always tended to be a much slower trainer than I was a racer. And you can interpret that as a negative. You can say, boy, I just was really a quitter in workouts. When I was running, 3:45 for 1500, I trained with a bunch of guys who were running just under 4 minutes for 1500 and we worked out together. So obviously I was a failure as a workout guy. But the other way to look at that is that I was a very good racer. Mm-hmm. That for a given level of workout, I was able to push harder in races. So whenever someone is telling you how hard you should be working out, they have to make some assumption about, what it means for you to work out versus to race. And nobody really knows that. So, all workout prescriptions are starting points. They're averages based on the population and they may not apply to you. So if you're not able to complete the workouts you think you should be able to complete, that doesn't mean there's something wrong with you. It means there's something wrong with the workout relative to your abilities to do it.
I'm glad you mentioned that because I think that is quite a common thing. And especially people, I know a lot of recreational runners listening probably feel, I've heard things that you'll say like, oh, this person will be disappointed in me. They thought I could do this, but I can't. And you just mentioned there about you training with, sub 4 1500 runners when you were running 3:45 in your races. Now, that could have been very easily a situation in a workout where you could have said, oh my God, why am I surrounded by these people? I should be way ahead of them. And you could have said, oh, I'm going to drop out because obviously something's wrong with me. But you obviously didn't. You kept to it. And that's a good real life example for people to take in and and listen to here, because as Alex mentioned, it doesn't really matter how fast you finish. If you've got into the habit of doing that, finish it regardless of what speed you finish at. So go on.
And I would add a story there that,
yeah. You
know, so it took some sort of self-confidence in myself to think this is how I should be working out because this is what's worked for me. But obviously that confidence wasn't always there and I was full mm-hmm. of doubts too. So I can remember at one point, you know, talking to some of the other runners from across the country who were running at sort of similar paces to me and finding out what workouts they were doing and thinking, holy mackerel, those guys are doing workouts that are way more impressive than me. If I'm going to compete with them, I need to do their workouts. And so at one point I got a workout from one of my sort of friends / competitors that he had done. And I thought, I'm going to go home and do this. And so instead of doing my own workout, I tried to do my friend's workout, he was a guy who raced roughly the same times as me. We were very close competitors. And it was absolutely demoralizing because the workout was something like 4x800 meters or something like that. And I couldn't even do the first one at his pace. Mm. And then when I tried to do the second one, I was 10 seconds slower. And by the third one, it's like, oh, well, something must be wrong. And I quit the workout. And that was a mistake because I was trying to match what he could do in workouts. And the truth was, I was beating him as often as he was beating me doing my workouts. And so trying to do his workouts was just both physically and mentally not the right choice for me. You have to sort of, at the end of the day, the fundamental point of a workout is to do some hard sections and easy sections to the point that at the end you're like, well, that's as far as I could have gone today, mm-hmm. as hard as I could have gone today. And what number is attached to that particular workout, that's irrelevant. Your body doesn't care.
Yes.
You know, exactly how fast you ran. Your body cares, did you work hard today? And so that's what your job is, to work hard, not to hit a certain pace in a workout.
Mm-hmm. I love that. Thank you so much for saying that. And Alex, you don't know this, but I know a lot of my listeners do. Since I've started running again postpartum, every single run has been by minutes. I haven't done a single thing with miles or distance because I've just found it so refreshing to just know, did I run as hard as I could in that 4-minute effort? Yep. And that's all I can do. And it's just been a complete life change for me, just enjoying that. So I'm glad to hear you say that because I'm all about that. Okay, one more thing I wanted to ask you. Well, actually, I didn't want to. This is a listener question. Thank you, Richard, for this, who wants to know, of all the studies you've read and researched, what has made the biggest change in you as an athlete?
Oh,
we know
gosh,
it's not beets now because you gave up some information that you don't eat or drink beet juice.
Yeah, well, I should say I do eat beets. I think they're very healthy, but okay. I don't take beet juice.
Okay.
The single study that has made the most difference to me as an athlete.
Caffeine, that seems to be one that you go round and round with.
Yeah, I don't drink coffee and I don't ever take caffeine before races. I'm intellectually interested in these things, but I you know, and it would be different if this was 20 years ago and I was trying to compete at a very high level. But right now, competition for me is more about mm-hmm. personal pushing. So let me answer this with a question, with a study that I found very fascinating and that I've thought a lot about. Okay, I'll just tell you the study just because it cracks me up. This was a study where they brought in a bunch of people they were cyclists actually, to do a time trial or an endurance test in the lab. And before they did the endurance test, they all had to watch a video of a woman making herself vomit and then eating the vomit.
Oh, was she actually eating it or was it?
Yeah, yeah. This was like a real disgusting video. So they all watched the video, or at least maybe some of them didn't watch the video, but two groups watched the video. And one of them was just instructed to watch the video, then get on the bike and do the endurance test. And the other one was instructed to watch the video, but not to show any emotion while watching the video. So keep a total poker face. If you're feeling disgusted, don't show it. You have to suppress that emotion. And when they then got on the bikes, the people who had to suppress their emotion had performed much more poorly in the time to exhaust or in the endurance mm-hmm. test than the people who had just been able to let it all out. And so this is kind of, it ties into a lot of the sort of mental fatigue and focus and cognitive regulation stuff that I've been really interested in. And so it's the idea that, I mean, what is endurance other than the prolonged process of suppressing your very natural and logical desire to slow down?
Sure,
you
yeah.
have to keep resisting your natural urge. And that's a fatigable task, so that if you're doing that beforehand by regulating your emotions while watching this video, it turns out that you can then see a measurable difference in your performance. Huh. And so now I'm not saying that I now before every run watch a video of a vomiting woman and you know, let
you
my emotions show. Yeah, yeah, exactly. It's don't look at my browsing history. But it's something I think about in terms of the role of the mind and the role of cognitive fatigue and what I'm doing mentally, whether it's, you know, doing my taxes or doing, you know, engaging in cognitively or emotionally difficult situations, that it's going to affect me. And so, you know, I guess in terms of its practical impact on me, it's just something that I'm much more aware of now when I'm even in training. Mm. If I'm going through other things in my life, I'm much more ready to understand that, yeah, I'm going slow today because I had, you know, arguments with an editor or something like that. And then, you know, I had to bite my tongue and not say what I really thought or whatever the case may be. If there's any editors listening, I'm not talking about you. And just, it's given me a sort of broader perspective on the things that affect my physical performance that normally I would have thought of myself, you know, or at least, you know, 10 years ago, I would have sort of had this view of my physical capacities in a separate box for what's going on in my head and my mind and stress and fatigue and emotion and things like that. But studies like that have helped me to sort of realize their connection and in a sense to cut myself some slack in training when there's other stuff going on in my life.
Mm-hmm. I love that. Thank you so much for explaining that as well, because I think that's something that we all need that reminder time and time again. Trent Stellingworth talked about that exact thing earlier this year. So thanks for the reminder of that one. Now, I'm just going to wrap up here, and I'm just going to take a moment to give our listeners a short message, and we'll be back with the final four. You're committed to being your best. You want more energy, better sleep, longevity, and improved overall health. Maybe you've tried out a diet that you've read about online and taken a few supplements that maybe you've heard are important for runners. But it's time to stop guessing and start improving. Inside Tracker is committed to help you get there using science and technology. Their cutting-edge algorithmic engine will analyze your blood, nutrition, and lifestyle and guide you to goals with actionable and personalized recommendations. Every body is unique. We know that. You personalize your training, so why not personalize your diet and supplementation routine? Inside Tracker tells you the best foods and supplements to add to your current routine, why you need it, and at what frequency. You can track your progress and adjust based on real feedback from your body. Take advantage of Inside Tracker's blood analytics with a special opportunity for Running For Real listeners. Use code TINA for 20% off all plans until the end of January, only at insidetracker.com. Overcoming Amenorrhea is coming out in the world on January 21st, just a few weeks away. I've worked really hard on making it the best it can be, and it's something I'm proud of. This book is not just about overcoming amenorrhea, it's also about learning to love who you are. It would mean the world to me if you could purchase a copy either now through pre-order or the week it comes out. Let's be real, as much as we may have good intentions to remember things like this, sometimes I might note something in my mind and think, sure, I'm going to remember it when the time comes, but somehow I don't. But it is so important to me to make sure as many people purchase it as possible in this pre-order period or in the week it releases. That will help me to get to be the bestseller for my category of the book, which sets me up for life as an author. If you think there's even a tiny chance that you'll forget about it that week because, well, life happens, please consider signing up to my email newsletter and I'll let you know when it's out. I promise my emails are not spammy. They're just weekly check-ins with the thought of something maybe you could be going through, and you'll be amazed how often I'm right with those. A challenge for something to build your confidence and some updates. You can sign up at tinamuir.com/subscriber. Thank you so much for your support, my friend. I will be forever grateful if you get yourself a copy. All right, Alex, four more questions for you, starting with one piece of advice you would like to give listeners for life.
Yes, I was forewarned about the question, so I had time to think about this. You know, what one piece of advice for life is tricky, but I came up with get out the door. This is the advice I give myself in a narrow sense for running, that, you know, there's a lot of days when I'm not really enthused about going and doing a long run, but I always just make sure I get out the door. And I give myself permission sometimes for a 10-minute run. If I get out the door and after I'm not, I'm not feeling it, I'm tired, I've got too much else on my mind, I'll turn around and go back home. But, you know, 9 times out of 10, once you get out the door, you realize that it's actually nice to be out there running. That I think you can sort of apply that in a more metaphorical way too, that in trying new things, in setting big, sometimes it's very daunting that something seems like it's going to be really hard or you're not sure you want to put yourself through it. You know, just get out the door and give it a try. Don't necessarily force yourself to think you have to achieve everything you're dreaming of, but at least get out the door and give it a try, and you'll be surprised about what may ensue.
Yeah, love that. Good advice. All right, one person to follow on social media and why?
you mentioned Trent Stellingworth. He was my pick.
Really?
Yeah. So the thing is, I follow a lot of athletes on social media because it's interesting to see what they're up to. I also follow a lot of scientists on social media because that's, you know, it's, I read about research with endurance and things like that. There's a relatively small number of people who really effectively straddle those words, who speak with scientific rigor, so with firsthand experience of what it takes to, you know, to make it to an Olympic final, as Trent's wife Hillary did. Or she didn't make it to the final. She should have. It was 2012 London, when there were like 6 dopers in the final of the women's 1500. But anyway, an Olympic athlete. So Trent is he's a physiologist at the Canadian Sport Institute Pacific. He has a background, I think his PhD is in sports nutrition.
Yeah.
But he's a physiologist in general. Has a ton of practical experience working with elite athletes in a variety of sports. He coaches people, including his wife. So for me, he's one of the great examples of someone who speaks both languages of athlete and of the scientist, and tries to bridge those. And so his Twitter feed, which I think is T. Stellingworth, is it's very interesting. And he posts and comments. And retweets and stuff. So if you're looking to sort of get a window into what is the applied practical world of sports science thinking about, is Trent's a good place to start.
Absolutely. I would totally agree with that. And he is a great guy as well, just in addition to everything else. So definitely recommend him. And I will put a link to the interview with him as well as Trent's social media handles. All right, Alex, how do you want to be remembered?
As a guy who's still here. I was thinking about this, and it's like when you meet someone for the first time, or when you leave a social engagement and you're like, what's the impression I hope I left? And fundamentally, I think when I sort of tried to think about it, I think ultimately my highest hope is that I want to be remembered as a nice guy, not as like the greatest or the smartest or the most accomplished or whatever the case may be. I just hope that in any context, whether it's a social gathering or in life, that I was a nice guy to be around and, you know, gave more to the gathering than I took away.
I think you are definitely fulfilling that so far, but definitely can agree with that in everything you just said there. All right. And finally, I can't remember, did I give you a running for real moment or a start line question?
You mentioned both. So,
okay. Which one would you rather answer?
I'll give you a running for real because we mentioned beet juice before.
Go for it.
So as I was saying before with the Vaporflies, I had this 5K race that I run every year and I wasn't in shape. And I thought, I'm going to pull out this. I need to get every mental edge I can get as well as physiological edge. So I wore the Vaporflies shoes and I decided I'm going to try beet juice for the first time. I've written like 40 articles or something on how and where and why to use beet juice. I've never tried it and I've never taken, you know, and beet juice companies keep offering me to send me samples. And I say no, cause I don't take samples, but somehow a beet juice company found my address. I think they must've looked up the domain registration of my website or something like that. So they sent me.
And now you've just told people how to do it so that you're going to get more stuff now. Anyway, keep going.
No. as long as it's cash, send cash to that address. But, so I had these beet shots. And so my wife and I were both running the 5K. We're like, okay, let's take the beet shots. Let's take every edge we can get. So the night before the race, we each took a beet shot. My wife took like a quarter of it. She was like, whoa, I can't handle this. Get this out of here. I just downed the whole shot. And it was like 3 seconds later, I could feel my intestines starting to like convulse.
Oh, wow.
And I was like, oh, this could be trouble. But I went through with it the next morning, an hour before the race. I took my second beat shot. And look, I won't go into the details here, but just, let's just say there were a number of porta potties trips before, between, you know, 1 hour before the race and the start of the race, pitching porta potty trips. And it was one of those things where it's like, man, I need to be careful giving advice about things that I haven't tried, because mm-hmm. And I knew in theory, like every article I've written has mentioned that some people experience gastrointestinal problems and you should not under any circumstances do what I did, which was try it for the first time. But yeah, it was a reminder of A, that I'm an idiot, and B, that the difference between theory and practice is important, and you need to understand how you react to mm-hmm. things. And fortunately, I will say this story does not end with me, you know, having to change my shorts partway through a 5K. Everything went fine. I made it to the finish line, but it was definitely sitting in that porta potty. I was like, wow, this is pretty real.
That is a very real moment. Thank you for sharing. And it's funny that was the day. So that was the same what day you decided to wear the Nike Vaporfly.
I went Vaporfly, beet juice.
You just did everything different.
Think of it was like, yeah, I don't think I found it. Or maybe I should have tried caffeine too. That would have been the ultimate.
Well, that could be next year. You can just change everything about, you can maybe run barefoot for that race and see how that goes.
Hey, now we're talking. Yeah.
Okay. Alex, how can people find out more about you? I will put links to Indoor in the show notes, but how else can people follow you in the future?
Yeah, probably the simplest place is on Twitter. My handle is Sweat Science, and that's where I'm probably most active in terms of posting articles and other stuff that I'm posting. I do have a website, alexhutchinson.net, which has more sort of older articles and bio stuff. But yeah, Twitter's a good thing.
Great. Well, thank you so much for sharing your insights with us once again. It's been wonderful. You are definitely a good person, and everyone listening can know that even if they didn't before. So thanks for your insights, and we appreciate you.
Thanks, Tina. I really appreciate it. It was fun to talk.
My friends, if you have a minute and you could leave a review on your favorite podcast player, Apple Podcasts, aka iTunes, Stitcher, Overcast, Pocket Cast, Spotify, or whatever else podcast player you use to listen to this podcast, or if you would subscribe to this podcast, you will help me get out in front of new runners to make our tribe even bigger and even better. It might not seem like you as one person can make a difference, but really, it helps a lot. And it shows me you appreciate the hard work I put in for those. Thank you so much. I feel like I could listen to Alex and his wisdom for hours. You can tell there's no ego involved in what he's doing. He doesn't do this or learn about things for the fame and the attention. He does it because he's interested, and he looks at everything from such a fair perspective. I'm just honestly not sure I could ever really give it that fair of a looking at, I guess. Do you think you could have kept those Nike Vaporflies 4% on your shelf for that long? I certainly couldn't. It would be way too tempting, I should say. I will be interested to hear how many of you try them after what Alex said. If you do get yourself a pair, be sure to tag me in your post so I can see what you think, because I'm genuinely curious to see how people get along with them and if they think they're worth the money. On that note, if you did enjoy this episode, please screenshot it and share it to your social media and tag me. That helps others to find the podcast, and I really appreciate it. There's links to that and everything else we talked about in the show notes at tinamuir.com/episode98. And remember, can you go to tinamuir.com/pre-order or go to the show notes to pre-order my book, Overcoming Amenorrhea? It comes out in less than a week, and your pre-order will go such a long way to helping me. So thank you so much in advance. Have a great week.
Thanks for listening to the Running for Real podcast. Be sure to check out tinamuir.com for show notes and even more helpful running information.